Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program that many of you listeners have come to know and trust. And we are continuing a milestone interview with Anita Dittman, Holocaust survivor, 86-year-old Anita, who wrote the book Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and of course lived the whole terrible 12 and a half years trapped in Hitler's Hell. And this wonderful book, you do want to get a pen and paper, and you do want to realize that you can go to Lighthouse Trails Publishing, I guess that's lighthousetrails.com, and you can order this book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, for $12.95 plus $5 shipping. I'm looking right here to see if there is a telephone number listed. Yes, here is an order line also. So listeners, for Trapped in Hitler's Hell, you can call toll-free 866-876-3910. And again, that is 866-876-3910. And actually, you can write to Lighthouse Trails Publishing Company, P.O. Box 958, Silverton, S-I-L-V-E-R-T-O-N, Oregon, 97381. And I believe perhaps that address has changed. So it would be best to use the toll-free number to get the newest information on their address, 866-876-3910. Last week, when we began interview part one, Anita recounted how she was growing up in the 1930s in Germany, and she had a promising ballet career just about to take off. And her family was a little unusual in that her father was an Aryan German and her mother was Jewish. And they did not foresee what terrible things were going to come till the reviewer in the paper said that they didn't wish to be entertained by a Jew. Little 7-year-old Anita Dittman's ballet career stopped. And of course, then events began to escalate. Terrible Kristallnacht, and a neighbor warned Anita's mother not to send her girls out. By this time, the father, sadly, had deserted his post as a father and a husband. He had left the family. So in that first part, Anita told very much about her mother's kindness one Christmas time to a lady who happened to be a dwarf and who was hungry. She gave away their last meal, and the children, Anita and her sister, wondered how they would be fed. But the very next day, someone brought them food. The mother's mercy, I believe, was rewarded later in her life. So now we came to the time that Anita had a warning dream in which a boat was leaving and her mother was on the boat. And there were more details to this dream, and you can find them in Trapped in Hitler's Hell. So Anita was left. Her mother was sent to the dreaded concentration camp, Theresienstadt. Anita was left to continue doing labor. Now, she had someone who was like a father surrogate, and that was her pastor. And she told about Pastor Horning that she had learned later in life how very brave he was. He was not one of these 501c3 pastors that we now have in America, chained to worry about IRS so that they can never speak up against wrong the way the Bible tells them. No, Pastor Horning, Anita told us, had written directly to the Führer, directly to Hitler, to complain about his policies back in the 1930s. And it is really, I believe, providential that God protected him from being taken to a camp very soon. And now let's pick up the story. Welcome to the program, Anita Dittman.
Well, thank you. I feel very honored that you are wanting me to be part of your program. And
we are honored to have you.
I enjoy listening to you because you enunciate your words very well and you speak clearly, and that's very nice. I appreciate it. Not everybody is that way.
Why, thank you. I guess as an ex-reading and English teacher, that comes across a little bit. Plus, I had a mother who was an English teacher, and I was really imploring me to always try to speak clearly. Now, the unforgettable story that you've been telling us, has an overarching figure, and that is Jesus Christ. We are a Christian program here, and we do believe that persecution may not be too far into the future here in our beloved America. God has stayed us from terrible events coming. We think recently some things we won't get into here, but it looks as though some very brave, patriotic men have once again saved us from terrible things coming, perhaps Hitlerian things. And it is the prayers of people who listen to this program. I think most of you who are listening are probably over the age of 35 or maybe over the age of 60. But your prayers are not meaningless. We get some letters from all of you, and we ask that you will very prayerfully tell others about Anita's book, because I think it is a key book in strengthening people for things that may come that we have never dreamed could come here in our beloved America. Now, let's just pick up after your mother was taken. The Gestapo knocked on your door again to collect your mother's possessions. Would you pick up the story right there?
Okay. Excuse me. When the Gestapo came to pick up my mother, she had to fill... Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The Gestapo had come. It was the 7th of January, 1944. And they had come in to pick up my mother this time. And she had to fill out and sign a statement that every item in that one room where we lived in was her possession. And they put labels, red labels on every item. And then they told me, they warned me, don't touch anything because tomorrow the Gestapo officials would come and take everything out that has a red label, and they would take it to the headquarters of the Gestapo for the warehouse. And if I wanted anything back, I would have to come and pay for it. Well, of course, on my hard labor salary, I didn't make much money. I just barely was able to feed myself. But my mother had a moment before they took her. And I was privileged, though, that I could take her to the gathering place where they brought everybody that was going to be shipped off the next day. And so in short before we left the apartment with the Gestapo officials, she handed me a slip of paper with my father's phone number. And she whispered to me, she said, call your dad. I think he can help you not to lose the furniture. And oh, sure enough, the next day my dad came. And I won't go into detail. It's all written in detail in the book. But I was able to keep my furniture, and I was very grateful for that. And I think my father bonded then because he realized I was all alone, and he was had remarried, and his wife, his new wife, had a good influence on him. So we kind of had a better relationship with each other. Well, my mother was sent to Theresienstadt, and I didn't know that at first. But after I found out, I was amazed that they were allowed to receive food packages, and these are really miracles. And I was too poor to buy food on the black market, so I had to make a decision. And I had to make a decision to share with what little food I had. And I asked the Lord, I said, please, I will be eating very little, but you and I'm working hard. Please keep me strong so that I can continue to work and help my mother with food. And he did. For 7 months he did that. Among other things in the package that I sent, I always sent the German rye bread. And this is very important, and you will find out soon why. The German rye bread is very solid. You could almost sit on it without making a dent into it. And it's very nourishing and non-perishable. So it was very rewarding that after about 10 days or so, I received a little card from my mother that she was allowed to write and stating all the items that she had received, because it was a known factor that the Nazi guards would help themselves to the contents of these food packages. They didn't need the food, but just out of meanness. So I was so happy that she had received everything. But She was picked up on the 7th of January, about June, latter part of June. I had a strange feeling when I was looking in the stores for what to send to my mother. I decided not to send the dark bread, but sent Zweiback, which is toast. And I got a whole big package because everything was, these ration cards were all by weight. I was so happy. I bundled up everything and shipped it off and couldn't figure out why was I doing it. And I thought, well, maybe the starvation that I was living on was affecting my brain, only to find out 10 days later that my mother had been stricken. Excuse me. I've got a cold. My mother had been stricken with dysentery, and she could not eat the dark bread. She could only tolerate Zweiback, and she prayed to God to convey that to me. And it makes me teary. I'm sorry. But I was so awed by God's greatness. He actually conveyed that to me, and that's why I sent her the Zweiback. And I thought, wow, I always call it my hotline to heaven. And, you know, if you call on God and he doesn't respond right away, don't hang up. Wait.
Yes, that is a wonderful encouragement. We had a little bit of technical trouble. We hope that entire story went out to you listeners. I believe that it did. And you might also tell the listeners what your food situation was you were sharing. What did you receive to eat every day as you were doing the hard labor? And perhaps you'll tell about that.
Yeah, well, we had ration stamps. And since I was sending at least half of my food to my mother, but, you know, I had to mention that. I didn't think I was, you know, so great that I was doing that. I merely figured my mother had made so many sacrifices on my account, raising me up until age 16. Now it was time for me to reciprocate. So I had about, I would say, a slice of bread in the morning and a cup of imitation coffee. And then I would work long hours. It was not an 8-hour day, 10 hours. I worked hard. And yeah, and I had nothing for lunch, and then I'd come home for supper. I'd have a thin, watery soup with maybe a little cereal or something, some oats or something swimming around. And maybe, if I was lucky, I would get a hold of a head of lettuce and have a little lettuce. Everything else went to my mom. And, you know, I never lost a pound of weight. I was slender to begin with. I never had a cold. I never had the flu or anything, and I remained totally untouched by any epidemic that was around me. God,
that isn't
so
normal.
Great.
That is absolutely not normal, is it?
No, but it's wonderful. God specializes in making the impossible possible.
Yes, so, he does. And thou, and also, what kind of labor were you doing? What were your days actually like?
You mean in the factory or at the camp?
I guess the first place you were at the factory.
Oh, the first one was a jam factory. They made jam and also dried foods that were sent to the battlefront. And I had to carry very, very heavy, 100 pounds by myself. Sometimes I would carry that much weight 24 times in one 10-hour day. And then also, then the boss took me into the office. Well, I was a pretty blonde girl. I looked like any German girl, and I guess I was appealing to him or something. Anyway, he said, well, you know, you could help us in the office. And I had office work, and of course, it was nice and warm, and I didn't have to lift heavy, so it was great. But he also told me that during lunchtime, I was not allowed to go to the locker room for the Jewish people. And I said to him, that's where my mother is. I like to go, please. I said, I've lost so much. I've lost all my relatives. My mother's the only one. I want to be with her. Well, he said, I give you orders, you can't. And so I thought, nuts to it. The German people, they didn't like me. So I did go. I defied him. And I said, he had no right to do that. After all, you know, I'm partly Jewish. And then somebody squealed and told him that I continued to go to the locker room for the Jewish people, and my mother was. And so he confronted me one day, and he hit his fist on the table, and he said, and excuse me if I use that, but in German, damn it, he said, I'm going to, I told you you can't go there. And I said, why? Why would you feel this way? Don't ask why, he said. And if you don't obey, then I'll report you to the Gestapo. And I said to him, go ahead. And then I thought, wow, that was pretty daring. But, you know, from then on, he treated me with a lot of respect.
Isn't that interesting? Yes, but the courage then
before I told him to go ahead, I said to him, I would rather work in the factory and carry heavy weights and be with my mother in the locker room than to work here in the nice warm office. So if you don't mind, I would like to go back to the factory. And he said, I need you here. Well, sure, we were cheap labor, you know. But at least he respected me after that, and he didn't bother me again.
And I think that's important. Sometimes the Lord leads us in the way that we should stand up to the bullies, and sometimes we are treated with respect. Now, let's get to the next miracle when you sent your mother the bread.
Oh, okay. Well, this is now when I came, my mother recovered, and I continued to send her the bread. Well, this was now the 9th of August. I had been alone now for 7 months, and I got a summons in my mailbox that the next day I would have to stand in line at the main railroad station, and I would be shipped off together with about 350 other people who had mixed backgrounds. And at least I had time, and I prayed. I said, Lord, please help me. Show me what I need to do to let my mother know that I can no longer send her any food packages. And I was so grateful that I wasn't just picked up. At least I had an evening to think. So the Lord inspired me to go to the nearest grocery store that was still open, and I went in there, got a big, nice 2-pound loaf of dark pumpernickel rye bread with the company label on one end. And when I got home, I very carefully trimmed that label off and took a knife and made a deep indentation into the bread and rolled up a note that I had written to my mother, not to worry, I'm fine, and we'll probably soon see each other again, just don't give up hope, and God bless you. And I stuffed that way down into the bread with the knife. And then I called an Aryan friend of mine who didn't have to go to camp, and I asked her, could you possibly come over? And I told her what I need her, that I need her to mail the bread the next morning because I couldn't. I had to go to camp. And she was there. I thought she was flying. She was there right away. And I wrapped the bread up, and I prayed over that wrapped up loaf of bread and said, Lord, please protect this loaf of bread from falling into the hands of a Nazi guard. Because if they would have found out, if he would have found the note, they would have killed my mother. So 11 months later, after many, many months of the most horrible situations that I had to go through, I found out that for the first time, the loaf of bread had arrived at my mother's totally and completely covered with a thick layer of fluffy green mold. The Lord put it there to protect the loaf from being taken by a Nazi, and my mother, in turn, was so starved that she sliced one slice after another when she hit the note. Isn't this fantastic what the Lord can do? I tell you, I get all teary when I talk about the greatness of God. It's not that the situation in Germany and the pain and everything makes me teary, but it is always the greatness and the love of our Heavenly Father.
Yes, it's a wonderful witness. And on the first part of this program, you told how you really were saved by Jesus Christ at a very young age. And people thought it was just a whim or a fantasy, but you really knew. How old were you then?
I was 7 years old, not quite seven. It was short before my seventh birthday. And what was so awesome, my mother believed in a weird religion. And my father was an atheist, so I had no Christian nurture as a little child. Neither did my older sister. But then God sent me playmates that lived right above us, and they always invited me to their church, to go to church with them. And I give my mother a lot of credit. She did not keep me from going. It was so wonderful because it was on a early Easter morning, early in the morning, when I had gone to church with them, and as I was sitting there, and I'd been in that church many, many times. But that morning was special. And the sun was shining through the stained glass windows, and the windows depict Christ's birth, life, death, and resurrection. And it was just like at one point out of the one glass window, as if he had stepped out. He didn't, but it was kind of, I visualized that. And it was a wonderful feeling, not a fantasy, not an emotional feeling. It was real. I had a peace inside of me, and I felt a security that I had never, ever felt before, not even during those first 5.5-plus middle-class years. I was so happy. And I told my friends about it, and I said, do you think I'm crazy? No, they said, that's the way it's supposed to be. Let's run home and tell your mom. So we all ran home together, and when I bursted into the door in our little apartment, my mother and my sister were sitting there, and I told them about it. And my sister raised her eyebrows like she always did, you know. I was her stupid little sister. But my mother said, oh, honey, it's just a childish fantasy. I said, no, Mom, it isn't. But I didn't let that discourage me. I started to pray for them. And it was in 1938, or short before 1938, that we met this wonderful pastor. And it through his preaching, teaching, and his bold lifestyle that did not count anything, you know, that he was not afraid of the Nazis. He didn't sell out to them like so many pastors did. And he invited us to come to church there, and Mother and my sister and I went. And then we finally went to Bible study, and it was after a few months of Bible study, my mother turned her life over to Christ.
And, you know, Anita, what is so interesting to me is that weird religion that your mother was connected with, Theosophy, it was really started by Madame Blavatsky. And Madame Blavatsky was the origin of the New Age religion now, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And she channeled the Ascended Masters. And these were spirits. Of course, we would say as Christians, these were demonic spirits.
Yeah.
But interestingly, some of what she channeled was this, that eventually before the world would have the one world religion, all Christians and Jews would have to be killed. So it's interesting that your mother did not know she was an innocent little lamb being a Jew, but Jesus knew. And when he stepped out figuratively into your consciousness and into your soul, he did step out. He saved you and your mother. I think this is a very ironic thing that what she was connected with was something that hated her.
But you know what was so...
Go ahead.
But it was so amazing. after a few months, my mother turned her life over to Christ, and she looked at me. She said, why was I so stupid, she said about herself, and so stubborn? You got this all brought into your heart as a little child. And I said, Mom, don't worry. It's just God's timing now, and it's wonderful. Now we have something we can share. And she said, I will never, ever call you having childish fantasy. And she said, I'm sorry that I treated you that way. I said, Mom, you just didn't know any better, so don't feel bad. My sister, however, never, ever turned her life over to Christ. Never.
And that is sad.
That was very sad. Yeah, she, unfortunately, when she came to see us in 1961, when they visit us, she came from England, we witnessed to her, and she said, I don't want to hear about it, she said. She was like my father, she said. But she believed in that theosophy and in astrology, just like my mother did. I never wanted to have anything to do with it. My mother would tell me about it, and I said, Mom, it sounds weird. But
yes, it definitely is a false path. And I know I was interested in astrology and numerology in the 1970s and 80s. And I actually did a couple numerology charts for people, and I certainly have repented over that. I was all enthusiastic over Edgar Cayce. And first of all, his prophecies, they didn't come true. Second of all, when I reviewed it again a year or two ago, there was him channeling. Supposedly he was a Christian, but he's channeling these spirits, and he's telling people how to get well, and he's espousing the Masonic ideals. And that's another thing, Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy were closely connected to Freemasonry. But that's another program, another story. Let's move now to what happened in the camp. How did conditions get much worse? And tell us about the story after you left.
Yeah, we went by train, but not cattle car, thank God. But we were to bring only a knapsack full with the most, you know, meager in belongings, some change of clothes and so on. Of course, it was warm outside, and so we didn't bring any winter clothes. We were about, I would say to begin with, about probably 300, 350, and then another transport came, and we grew in size, but we didn't count it, you know. But our camp was not surrounded by barbed wire, but we had such strict control by the guards that there was no way that anybody could have escaped. The women, about 150 of us, were housed in a filthy old cow barn, and the camp was located, I don't know how many miles. We you know, measured in kilometers. I have no idea, but a long, long ways north of my hometown. And the men were in a similar situation, only it was a horse stable and not too far from us. Men, people who were married, could not live together. They could work together, and that was it. And we had one faucet of water in that barn on the outside for washing ourselves, 150 women. And the toilet facility was an open ditch that they had a board suspended over it in a certain fashion. There were no doors, no protection from the elements or rain or anything. And then we were given two gray blankets that they usually used to cover horses with. We were awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning. We stood in line. We had to come all dressed for work. We were allowed to wear tank tops or shirts and shorts, and then heavy shoes that we had to bring from home. And then the men had the same kind of treatment. Then we were given some piece of bread and with I think there's some margarine on it and some a cup of hot of that imitation coffee, and then they loaded us up with picks, shovels, and spades, and they walked. We had to march off. They forced us to sing Nazi songs so it would look good to the, you know, the onlooking, it was a rural area, and to the public, you see, so that we were all Nazis and not half Jews. But the people soon found out that that was not true. And then when we came to our place of work, we were going to be digging ditches, ditches that were about 10 feet, 8 to 10 feet deep, about probably 10 to 15 feet wide or more. And we worked about 10 hours in the burning sun. For lunch, we would have thin, watery soup. And then we went on with our work. It was very, very heavy labor. It was very hot. We were told that if it rained, we would have a day off. It didn't rain for 4 weeks. It was terribly hard work. And I was grateful that the Lord had prepared me for that because I was an athlete from the time I was born. And then after that, I did all that heavy labor in the factory. So God prepared my body for this hard work. And I was grateful for that. And then after 10 hours of hard labor, we marched home and we stood in line for our hot food ration, which was a thin, watery soup, and again, some water to drink. And that was it. And we never knew what was swimming around in that soup. Very, very overly salty. And then we had free time. Well, we weren't really allowed to talk to each other when we were digging ditches. But some of us who are Christians, we couldn't keep our mouths shut. So we communicated quietly when the guards weren't looking. And pretty soon we had a little band of people, of course they're all women, that would be interested in having some Bible study and maybe singing some hymns. We were allowed to keep our Bibles. So our little band grew. But as things got worse, and the winter finally came, and we were transported off to another location. But I want to backtrack here. The ditches were going to be used to trap the Russian tanks that would come into the country. Even though Hitler proclaimed, you know, he was going to be winning, but still, he had us dig those ditches. And we were always told by our guides we should be so proud that we are working for Adolf Hitler. Well, no comment about that, but... Well, then when winter came, it got more difficult because we were fighting the winter elements, and it was cold, and it snowed a lot, but we had to work outside. We were now working in the forest, cutting trees, pine trees, and then we would make them into certain contraptions, and the book mentions that too, that were used to pave the walls of the ditches that we had dug so they wouldn't collapse. Oh, it was difficult then. It was so difficult. We were working in this miserable weather, and if it snowed, then we walked home with our clothes wet, and we had no place where we were stationed. It wasn't a barn. It was an old dance hall that was bitter cold, and then we had to go back to work with wet clothes the next day, and the winters were about as rough as they are in Minnesota. And it got plenty cold, and not only that, because of the lack of sanitation, we caught head lice from each other, and it took several days before some chemicals were brought to us to get rid of the lice. Oh, it was miserable. But it was at that point, about the end of November, beginning of December, when we were told that when our work was completed, we were going to be shipped to Auschwitz to be cremated. So then, from then on, we didn't complain that we had lice and that we were cold and that we were sick and the work was hard. We just thank God we were in Auschwitz yet.
And were the others about your age, or were there older people there too?
The ages were from age 15 to age 65.
So quite a variety. And did some of the older people probably weaken and not make it?
They did. Oddly enough, they did. It was amazing how the Lord protected us. And because I had hepatitis just about 6 months before I went to camp in a bad case because I wasn't allowed to stay home and had to go to work, I had stomach trouble. And the food that we had was so horrible, and I couldn't eat, really. So I lost about 18 pounds in a hurry. And when I had lost so much weight, the guards figured I wouldn't live much longer. And if you, you know, if you couldn't work, you didn't weren't allowed to live. So they put me into sick bay. And there, a nurse came, and she brought me a tiny little orange pill, very, very tiny. And she put that in my mouth, and then she gave me a cup of hot, it was kind of just a flour mix, flour and water and salt, and I was supposed to drink that to strengthen me to go back to work. But when the nurse left, the girl next to me in the bed, she was from my camp too, she had different problems. She said to me, "Don't take that pill." I said, "What can I do?" She puts it on my tongue. He said, "Then take it and push it with your tongue way up into under your lip there and keep it there. And then go downstairs to the outhouse and spit it out because they're trying to kill you because you've already lost so much weight." I was a moving skeleton. And she said, "They're going to kill you." But she said, "They're giving me potatoes, little potatoes with an odd gravy, but at least," she said, "when the nurse has gone out," and she said, "you go down to the outhouse, take that flour mix and pour it into the outhouse, into the bathroom, in the outhouse, and make vomiting noises. But try not to let the pill go. We'll get rid of it in some other way, because the nurse would probably go out and check." And I made terrible noises like I was throwing up. And the nurse would look, when she came every day, I would do that, and it would work. And she smiled, very satisfied. And I helped my friend to eat those potatoes, and they were like a filet mignon for me. And then they weighed me, and I had gained weight. They couldn't figure that out. So they sent me back to work, and she had terrible rheumatoid pains, and they sent her back too. So we were so grateful to God to be sent back to camp.
And again, wasn't that another instance of the Lord watching over you because
yes.
He wanted your life preserved, or you
yes.
wouldn't be here at age 86
exactly.
giving this interview?
Exactly. Well,
but then what happened to your foot? We must find out about your foot.
Oh, yeah, that is something. One evening on the 23rd of January, we were all called out. That's January 1945. We were all called out. We had not a very good Christmas to say, but I will talk about that later. And so we were all marched off that night. And that night I had a chance to escape because it was very, very dark, no moon, no light from anywhere. And I had some friends that I had met in my hometown, and they were three brothers, and their mother was in the same camp as my mother. So they asked, they said, "They know a way home. There is a train in the village that would take us back to our hometown, and they know a place where we would be safe to wait out the war, and come with us. And but my dear friend Christian, he kept me from going. He said, I don't want you to leave. Please, God does not want you to leave. And I said, no, I think it's you that doesn't want me to leave. And I smiled. Honey, he said, I know why. I prayed about it, and the Lord has put it on my heart to keep you from leaving. And so my best friend, Hella, didn't go without me, so she stayed too. So we marched and marched and marched and marched until finally they found another campsite where we had to do heavy labor. And because of all the marching on icy roads and doing heavy labor, my shoes had worn out. And the authorities issued me a pair of shoes with a very rough tops, very coarse, and the sole was made out of wood. And because of the constant walking and working, a blister rubbed on my right heel, not underneath the heel, but around the back of the heel. And it grew and grew and grew. It was very, very large. And I noticed, because there was not much sanitation where we were now in that new camp, and we couldn't wash our bodies, we couldn't wash our socks, and I knew something had happened because I looked at the blister and it looked like it had started draining, but it didn't stay drained. It grew shut, and I had fever. I could feel this. The lymph glands in my right leg started hurting and swelling, and the foot had strange discoloring, and I knew I had the blood poisoning. So I prayed. I said, Lord, keep me walking. Help me not to limp, because if the Nazis would have known, they probably either would have clubbed me to death or shot me to death. Sometimes, and the only person that I told about it was my best friend, Hella, because you couldn't trust even our own people. Some of them would squeal on us so they get more food ration. Well, it was now the 23rd.
And Anita, the ones who did leave, did they get back to your hometown safely, or
no,
did something happen to them?
Yeah, I found out after the war. I found out that they had gotten to Breslau, and then they were caught at the main railroad station. Evidently, the guards that had spotted them called to the headquarters and tipped them off to watch for these people. And they got caught and were taken to a apartment building close to where I grew up. And a bomb was dropped on them and they all perished.
So again, God warned you through your friend Christian. Well,
yeah.
Now pick up the story about your foot, and we'll move right on.
Yeah. And the escape. The escape was absolutely fantastic. That morning, early in the crack of dawn, we were hauled off. The women had to climb up on horse-drawn wagons, and the men were kept behind, that they could not go with us. The leader of our camp, who was a brute, he was an absolute maniac, a vicious man, he stayed behind with the men. And some of the other guides, and then two or three of our guides came with us, and they were riding on bicycles behind us. The wagons were pulled by horses, and the driver of them were Polish prisoners of war that worked on German farms, and we were whisked off, and we had to drive slowly because we had there was a lot of ice on the road. But finally, we came to another campsite. It was still fairly dark outside, but we could see an outline of barracks in the center of that complex, and then it was all surrounded by tall barbed wire fences that were electrically loaded, and we knew what that was. We didn't realize there were that many camps that littered the countryside. The gates swung open, and our driver let us off, but for some reason, one of the guards came to us. He said, we don't have any keys, and we don't have any kerosene lamps. And he said, I need volunteers that want to go to the nearest factory, which owned that camp, and get the keys and the kerosene lamps. And my friend Hella and I immediately volunteered. So we went with this lovely driver, this Polish driver, and we went with him. And on the way to the camp, we had spotted a railroad station. And it was far enough from the village where we had been kept in the camp. Well, we begged him, would you take us to the railroad station? And he smiled. And I had some cigarettes that my sister, my friend and I, we didn't smoke, so we kept these cigarettes hidden. And we gave them to him. And then I had some money that my mother had given me before she went to the camp. It's for emergencies. So I gave him some of that money, and he smiled, and he whisked the horse. And it just was amazing how fast that horse could run. And so we were far enough from the campsite that we were going to be in and got to the railroad station. And by that time, the other three girls, there were five of us that were very close through Christ, the other three girls, they had escaped to a forest, and it was still dark outside, and the guards were conferring and watching the people that were standing there so they don't run away. But these three girls got away, and when we got to the railroad station, they were already there waiting for us. So we shed our camp uniforms quickly inside the railroad station with a big trash barrel. And we had our civilian clothes underneath. And we noticed that out on the platform, there was a long, long train with cattle cars. And then attached to them were flatbeds. And each flatbed had a tank on there, a regular army tank. And there was a German soldier standing out there watching the tanks. And I said, you know, we had prayed all night that the Lord would find an escape if it was his will. And this was the escape. And so I looked the most Aryan because I had blonde hair just like my mother's side of the family, my father's side of the family. And when I came out there, there was this tall, handsome soldier. And he smiled at me when he saw me. And I smiled back and I said, what is this that you have on those flatbeds? Oh, they are slightly demolished Russian tanks that we confiscated, and we're taking them to Fürstenwalde, which is near Berlin, and the train will be leaving very soon, and they will be repaired, and then they will be reused. And, of course, the Russians were so close in that village where we had been that they were practically on our doorstep, and the villagers were all leaving. So we had a wonderful excuse, and we told him, which was true, but it wasn't a lie. I said, you know, my friends and I motioned them to come over to meet this lovely man, and his name was Valdemar, and we said, we are trying to escape from the Russians, which was true, partially. And he said, is there some way I can help you? And I said, could we ride in those tanks? Oh, he said, let me go into my commanding officer and ask. So he went inside the railroad station and came out with a big smile, and he said, yes. He said to me, he repeated it. He said, if you guys want to share your sandwiches with those five girls, go ahead. Put them in the tank. So he lifted us up. And pretty soon the whistle blew, and Valdemar came into the tank, and another soldier joined us. Eight of us. Five girls and two soldiers, so that's seven. Interesting.
And I'll interrupt here for the sake of time. We'll have to shorten some of the things because we do want to hear about, as you escaped further, how you went into the hospital. And, of course, you were seen as a German girl. And we want to hear about the nurse. And then we also want to hear how you found your mother. So we have about 9 minutes left. Let's go right to the hospital. About 9 minutes, I believe.
Okay, I'll hurry. And we parted with the soldiers when we're far enough from everything. We parted with the soldiers and then went on by train to a small town, Bautzen, where my girl and two girls went one way and my other two friends found refuge in the home of the in-laws, her in-laws. And so there we stayed. And I had to be hospitalized because the infection got worse. So they took me in a little kitty cart and hauled me over to the hospital. And I had fever. I had a bad high temperature. And the nurse that took care of me was a super Nazi. She greeted us with Heil Hitler, and she had the Nazi pin. And pretty soon, but she didn't know that I was not an Aryan. So then the hospital was overcrowded and understaffed because most doctors were in the battlefront. So and after about a week or so of just lying there, nothing was being done. The doctor couldn't come. A lovely lady doctor came, and she operated on me and cut because there was no antibiotics. So she drilled holes into my right foot, and the anesthesia was ether. And the nurse, that Nazi nurse, gave me the anesthesia, and I must have talked in my under the anesthesia and revealed who I was because the nurse changed. She had a terrible attitude. She was trying to kill me in a sneaky way because there was a medal for every German that would kill a Jew, and she wanted that medal. And because of what she did to me, I had to undergo 3 more operations in 6 weeks, but the doctor was not a Nazi, or she would have never operated on me again. She would have let me die. So God again sent an angel. And
the nurse was actually letting your bodily fluids go back in and contaminate the wound, I believe. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, what she did was, but that was a little later, the third surgery, I had to undergo 4 surgeries. The third surgery, they had cut a deep cut on the inside of the thigh because pus had formed a lump there. And with an open wound, she gave me an enema, put me on a bedpan, left me there for 2 hours. And during that time, all the feces and all the urine ran into the open wound and created more of an infection. So finally, I had to have a 4th surgery. And
let's move quickly to when the Russians came.
That 4th surgery, they had to enlarge the wounds, and there was still pus coming out. And the siren howled one day, and we were all taken to air raid shelters, and the Russians were coming in and out and starting to rape women. And all of a sudden, one day, they pulled me off my cot and threw me on a mattress right in front of all the men, women, and children that were in the hospital in that air raid shelter. And they were going to help themselves to me. But when they ripped off my clothes, they saw this horrible wound. And it was oozing with pus. It grossed them out so much they took off. And I had predicted that not knowing anything about it, I'd predicted to my friend when she saw my horrible wounds one day when she came to see me, I said, someday these wounds are going to be my protection. And here it was. I didn't know that this was going to happen. But I had a chance to witness to this nurse after all this happened because God sent me to her to comfort her, and I needed his help to do that, though. And when this nurse, when I sat down beside her and she put her arm around me, I put my arms around her. She wept on my shoulder profusely in between sobs. she told me that she had been raped several times. And I tell you, I cried with her because I realized what a horror that must be. And all of a sudden, she pushed herself away and she said, why are you doing this for me? Don't you realize I tried to kill you? I said, yes. And God gave me the strength to love you and to comfort you, and I forgive you.
And that is just the heart of your message completely. And we won't have time to hear all of the details of how you made your way to your mother at Theresienstadt. You were helped. And these details are in your book, but I would like you, there are about 3 or 4 minutes left. Tell what you can about finding your mother.
Yeah, I had to take a trip through. Finally, I got away from the hospital. They released me because the tubes had been taken out, and I escaped from one place to another. I had no cane. I had no crutch, nothing. The Lord just had to hang on to me and lead me, and he led me to a small town in Sudetenland, where I got a passport to go and find my mother. And it was a very traumatic trip. Very, very. But the Lord was with me every step of the way. And finally, when I reached my mother's camp, she had survived. And both of us had survived. And we had been separated for 18 months. And I tell you, it was a wonderful reunion. And after that, were taken to a refugee camp in Bavaria, and 11 months later, we sailed for the United States.
And when you saw your mother, tell the listeners what she was wearing.
Oh, yeah, she was wearing her pink bathrobe that she had forgotten to take with her when the guides picked her up and took her to the camp. I mean, to the synagogue where they gathered all the people for the next day to be.
And that was the
off.
One that you took to the synagogue for her. And another thing, because we're making a matter of record here, people who deny that the Holocaust ever happened and that there were no crematoria, tell what your mother had learned about Theresienstadt and the Red Cross man quickly.
Oh, well, it was short before the war ended. There was a fierce battle outside Theresienstadt, and it was between the Russians and the Germans. And it was short before that a man from Switzerland, from the Red Cross, came to visit the camp. And so he found out that these shower rooms were gas chambers. And they were almost ready to be used. And that's when this man came, a Mr. Dunang. And when he found out that these were not showers, he excused himself, took his Red Cross vehicle and the flag of surrender, and drove off and got it through this terrible battle and reached the Russian commander and pleaded with him to hurry and save the people. And they came and they did. And it's interesting how a heathen nation saved God's people.
Yes, and one person can make a difference. And Anita Dittman, what an inspiration you are to those of us who know you and have the privilege of being your friend. Again, listeners, we do urge you to order Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and you can call 866-876-3910. Again, that is 866-876-3910. Thank you, Anita Dittman, and we'll be in touch. God bless you.
And God bless you, too, and I'll call you sometimes to share some things with you, but I'll call you at
home. That will be great, and we wish all of you a good holiday season coming up. Good night for the Divided Kingdom.